My name is Susan Day, and I'm going to speak about optimizing ecosystem services before and after land development. And I think some of the topics that I want to cover relate to what types of ecosystem services we can expect from urbanized land and what we lose during land development. But I also want to throw out some ideas about new ways that we can be looking at ecosystem service management in cities. So briefly, I'm just going to talk about land development and how it affects ecosystem service provision and what kinds of ecosystem services we lose when we develop land in general. And then the sites program, I will speak a little bit about Sustainable Sites Initiative. And how many people in here are familiar with that? Three people. Okay, so I think that that has will have influence on future trends in quantifying ecosystem services in urban areas. And then I will briefly discuss a research project that we did with long-term soil rehabilitation. And this is a method for managing soil in developed land to try to recover some of those ecosystem services. Isn't there supposed to be a mouse up here? Oh, just here. Okay. All right. So this is just a classic land development site. And most of what I'll be presenting today is probably a little East Coast-centric because I think some of these things do differ by ecoregion. But this is your – where's my mouse? There it is. Okay. So this is classic developed land, and it has – the characteristics that you are probably all familiar with. So you have the topsoil and the O-horizon have all been scraped and removed. You have a lot of soil compaction. You have some contamination by all this limestone gravel in here. And then ultimately, this site becomes, partly it becomes a location for a building, but a lot of it becomes a location for plants. Okay, so in the context of cities, we get ecosystem services provided directly by our soils in terms of mediating the hydrologic cycle or storing carbon, but probably the bigger impact is what the soil supports. And so it's not just plants, but it's plants and then all the other ecosystem services that are associated with human interactions with plants. Here's another example. This is a little more intense, so this is also very common in terms of land development. So this is actually a future tree planting site on campus at Virginia Tech, and it looks really great, and the trees are just dying to jump in there, spread their roots out. But you see that you have the same kinds of things that you have in the land development, but you have it's confined, okay, so you have confined spaces, and then you have a lot more debris and rubble dumped in there, a lot more contamination. So this, for example, right here, I guess I have to kind of rub this multiple times to get it to come back. There it goes. This area right here is essentially concrete that was left over, just dumped there, so that's very common. And here's another site. This is a new building going up, and so you have that extremely compacted soil. And depending on the level of grading, it might be compacted in lifts, and so you can have very deep layers of soil compaction. And this area that you see right here is now a quote-unquote landscape. Okay. So this is a common scenario. So we have land development, we'll have removal of the topsoil, we'll have grading. You can usually see this by learning to read the land a little bit, and you see this very, very level area, the building over here to the right, and this steep slope over here to the left, and this should tell you that this is a fill site. Okay, so we have cut and fill in order to make a level place for the building, and so we have a lot of compacted soil in this area, and you can see that topsoil has been brought back here, but you have a drainage problem because of the compaction underneath, and the trees are actually already showing some dieback. You can see right back in there, even though they are red maples and very resilient. But what I want to point out to you is down here in the lower part of the slide, and since I was sitting in the audience in the back in this room earlier on, I realized it's very hard for you to see the bottom of the slide. So you're all craning over trying to see, because it is very, very hidden down here. But this is what happens. This is the result from our study where we had one treatment which essentially was we removed the topsoil, we put it, we stockpiled it for about a month, and we put the topsoil back. And that was it. Okay, that was the only thing that was done to this particular soil. And the results of just that small amount of handling, I mean, we're not even talking about the screening that is so extremely common that Bryant was describing, which is typical for most urban soils. They get screened and mixed and recycled and reconstituted. But the macro aggregates were reduced by 44%. 35% of the total soil organic carbon was lost, including 47% of the mineral-bound carbon. And then subsurface drainage was reduced from about 3 inches an hour to less than half an inch an hour. So you have a pretty, and this is the most minimal effect that you might expect for this kind of land development. In practice, lots of times it's considerably more damage. So you'll have soil that will be hauled off and stockpiled. It might be trafficked and compacted. It might be screened. You might have it completely removed and sold off-site. The subsoil might be, instead of just compacted by a few passes of equipment, might be graded and layered and so forth. So this is sort of the best-case scenario. So that's a pretty significant loss in carbon, and carbon storage in soils is a significant ecosystem service. And then we also have the stormwater management as another ecosystem service that's extremely valuable in urban areas. And there is a lot of effort and money and expense and policy and time spent trying to manage it. And so this is something that's really valuable that's offered by the soil itself. But all of these factors also affect the ability of the soil to support plants, right? And so this is an older community in Charlotte, North Carolina, and you see nice big trees, and you see lots of plants and pretty healthy-looking grass. But this is an older neighborhood where construction practices were considerably different. You know, this neighborhood was built back in the 20s, I believe, and you have kind of a different method of construction than we have now, not to mention time has passed. And so, okay, so we get ecosystem services from the soil, and we get ecosystem services from the plants that they support. So, for example, we might have a shade cast by trees that is going to reduce fossil fuel use to heat and cool our houses. But we also have a lot of public health and social well-being ecosystem services that relate to plants. And so this, just for example, is a street in Tokyo. And there's a lot of research in the last 5 or 6 years that has come out that's related to public health benefits of urban green spaces. And I know Sally was mentioning some that have to do with community gardens, but there's also many that have to do with trees. So in this particular study, the 5-year survival rate was increased among residents of this area. And primarily that's because they went out and they walk on the street. They're just getting more exercise, okay? So the longevity of elderly people in a neighborhood with trees as opposed to a matching neighborhood with no trees was greatly increased. And so the value of these kinds of ecosystem services we're really just beginning to quantify, but they all come back to the soil. You know, they're not really just coming back to what we call green infrastructure. The soil is the foundation of all of that. And so in terms of urban and anthropogenic soils in our division, I see that we have a lot of opportunities to really quantify the cascading effects of soil management in cities. And they're all different kinds of things. I mean, I'm generally focused on soil compaction and trees and because I'm interested in those areas, but the same could be said for the heavy metal contamination and all of the things that we've discussed. And I've included this picture in here. This is one of the remarkable trees of Virginia, and it's a beautiful cucumber tree. And I included it because I think that in cities we have sort of forgotten what could be in cities. Right, when you go outside this convention center, you see these the Palo Verdes, these small kind of struggling, well, they're not struggling too much. They actually look not too bad. But generally speaking, we'll see smaller trees that are in confined spaces. They're struggling somewhat. Plants are struggling. We rarely really see magnificent specimens of plants or really interesting or complex plant communities right in cities. But I don't think that there's any reason why we can't have spaces like that. It's just that we don't manage our soils and spaces to permit it. So there's my underlying message. Soils, plants, animals, people, and everything else. Okay, so the whole world depends on us, soils. And so all of these things here, so building stronger communities, the global ecosystem, avoiding sea emissions from fossil fuels and many other things, water quality protection, all of these things are critically important for us, and they're all ecosystem services, and they all kind of tie back, or they do definitely tie back to our soils. So this is where I want to introduce the Sustainable Sites Initiative. So for those of you who aren't familiar with this is a voluntary certification system that is now associated with LEED, which is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, which you know is probably the Green Building Program. So you have your LEED Gold Building and so forth. So back in the about 2006 or so, there was people were observing that it's very nice to have a LEED building and a green building, but what's going on outside the building is an abomination. And so what can we do about that? So this is sometimes referred to as LEED for landscapes. And essentially, the American Society of Landscape Architects and the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center and the U.S. Botanic Garden formed a coalition, and with the cooperation of agencies and sponsors and many people, formed this rating system. And it functions much like LEED, and it is also run by the U.S. Green Building Council. And it has credits and prerequisites in 10 categories and 4 levels of certification. And here's the steering committee, just to give you an idea of the folks who are involved in this. But the underlying metric for getting points in the site system is our friend, Ecosystem Services. Okay, so every single point in the site system is based on Ecosystem Services, and it's based on scientific research, okay, in as much as is available. Of course, sometimes there are gaps, but that is the goal and the ideal. And so everything is benchmarked against Ecosystem Services and outcomes. So instead of having points for a certain practice, you have points for increasing Ecosystem Services. Okay, so I think this is important for us in the soils world, because a lot of these points are tied to soils. Okay, so just to let you know, just this past October, the site's accredited professional credential was launched. And if you're familiar with the LEED program, you know there's LEED AP, LEED accredited professionals, and people who operate in that world to create LEED buildings get this credential, which essentially shows that you know how, you know, you're familiar with the system and how it works and so forth. So this has now gone through the pilot phase, it's gone through multiple public vettings, and it is in full force operation as of last month. So one of the prerequisites for the sites program is a soil management plan. And so this is essentially a soil management plan that is designed to optimize ecosystem services in urban settings. And that's essentially what that means. There are also numerous other credits that relate to soils in the sites program. So as just sort of a quick overview, there's emphasis given to where land development occurs, so the value of the existing soils to society. There's also credit given for protecting soil and soil plant communities, soil and vegetation zones, they're called. And then the final step is if soil is damaged by you or someone who came before you, then there's credits for trying to restore some of the ecosystem services that those soils provide. And so just to give you an example of how that might play out, this building is not a LEED certified building, but this is a building that was intended to be kind of a very high standard of green building. Okay, so the people who built this were dedicated to trying to have the most environmentally sensitive building that they could. Okay, and so they're working on creating a energy efficient building and a building that is very sensitive to the environment. Okay, but if you look at the soil, there's some issues here. Okay, so this was prime farmland soil. And if you go back here to this picture, you can see over here on the right, the original grade, okay? Part of that is a little mound of soil, but part of it's the original grade. This entire site, and over here, do you see these trees? That was also the original grade, the top of the of that little mound of soil and the bottom of those tree trunks. So they graded this entire site down about 3 feet, and so that water would drain to the back to a bioretention area in the back. And so there you can see it. And you can see that there's limestone gravel everywhere. And so now, 3 years later, this is sort of the prime time of year for plants to grow, for healthy-looking everything. And you have a lot of problems on this site. I mean, the ecosystem services that were lost during land development haven't been regained. Okay, we have very tough and resilient tree species that have been selected. Yet they're still suffering. Their canopies are thin. You can't see it too well in that picture, but there is a lot of dieback in there. And if you had planted these trees on the site before it was developed, this particular species, those trees would be double that size and dense in canopy by now. I mean, within 3 years, they grow very rapidly, and there'd be an enormous difference. The turf is also thin. So you have ecosystem services that are impaired. You have reduced carbon storage. You have reduced cooling from evapotranspirative cooling from the trees, reduced shade, reduced interaction of the people with plants. So they had a lot of aspirations to have community gardens and so forth out there, but they really are unable to do that now because of the fact that the soil is damaged. And I'm just going to skip through that. Okay, so now to the last part, I just want to give an example of a soil rehabilitation process and its effect on ecosystem services. And so this is a project that we conducted at Virginia Tech over about 7 years, and it was in response to people who were working in post-development sites who were interested in trying to restore some of the ecosystem services and soils, but the information gap is, can you quantify how if we engage in restoration practices, can we quantify what the ecosystem service recovery is? Because otherwise, it's very difficult to convince people to do it. And in terms of the sites program, now with the sites program in place, and we have part of it's been adopted by the federal government for new federal buildings. There's also opportunities to quantify the effects that soil management have on ecosystem services that can change the way we manage the green infrastructure that we have in cities that we're coming to increasingly rely upon. And there's so many gaps, and we've covered so many gaps during this our sessions so far. There's gaps in the engineered soils. We're having a symposium tomorrow on that. There's gaps in the soil contamination and the compaction, there's gaps everywhere. So just to briefly go through this process, we call it Soil Profile Rebuilding, SPR, and it is intended specifically to address the kind of compaction that you get from land development. So this is your typical developed soil. You have the compacted subsoil with its reduced drainage, and you have whatever's brought in on the top. In this case, there was some topsoil, but mainly it was brought in with the sod. And so in this study, we had four treatments. One was undisturbed, and I say undisturbed, it's really ag land, so it's not really undisturbed, but undeveloped, I should say. This is a typical practice matching the picture I just showed you. We're not going to talk about this one, and it's just sort of a variation. And then this is the profile rebuilding, which involves incorporating compost down to about 2 feet. Okay, so it's much deeper than you normally consider incorporating compost for agricultural use, because we're looking at that's where the compacted soil is. Okay. So in this technique, you put compost on the surface of your graded subsoil. You use a backhoe to incorporate it to 2 feet down, And what this does is when we take probes down there, and we also had mini rhizotrons, so you can sort of see a window into it. You get these kind of veins of compost running all the way down to the bottom that keep the large clods of compacted soil separated and allow for root development. Then you plant trees. Okay, and I just show this picture to emphasize there's a lot going on underground when you plant trees. So planting trees doesn't look like much when you got a little bundle in your hand, but they turn into that. Okay, so there's a big effect there. We immediately see in that compacted zone a significant reduction in bulk density from 1.9 to 1.35, but that's partly just because you're incorporating compost, which has a lower bulk density. But over time, over about a 4 to 5 year period, you retained that lower bulk density. If we looked at tree growth over about 7 years, we had about, you can get about double the canopy size. So in the urban forestry world, we're often looking at canopy cover as a way to estimate ecosystem service provision, and so you essentially double ecosystem service provision from trees. This is a graph that really, it just shows root depth, and so I just want to point out this green is profile rebuilding, and these are the depths, and the brown is undisturbed, and the red is your typical practice. And so you'll see, like here in our oak, our swamp white oak species, with a typical practice, you don't have any roots down deep below 12 centimeters, but you have a lot with the profile rebuilding and the undisturbed. And up here, you have some, but for the most part, you have a lot more roots at all depths with profile rebuilding. Okay, so this is just a graph to show you the carbon, and I'm going to go through this quickly. But the gist of it is that you have greater aggregate associated carbon in the subsoil there, as is illustrated by this area that's circled down here. You also have greater tree growth when we practice this in actual urban settings instead of in our controlled plots. This is in Arlington County, Virginia. You have increased, in addition to the aggregate associated carbon, you have increased hydraulic conductivity. The top here is influenced by the fact this is a carbon study and we have no surface treatment. But down here, where the compacted zone is, you have a tremendous influence from this practice. And there are a number of articles we've published on this topic. And I just want to finish off with just emphasizing that there's a lot more potential in cities for complex landscapes than we typically take advantage of. So we don't really need to assume that this is what we've got. Okay, we can try to aim a little bit higher, and I think that right now the stars are aligning such that research in urban soils has more value than ever. And with that, I would like to thank all my many collaborators, especially my three graduate students who worked on this project, Yujuan Chen, Rachel Lehman, and David Mitchell, who did a tremendous amount of work on this. And thank you very much.
And we can take one question. Questions?
Yes.
Is there any concern on your part with incorporating the organic matter at that step? And what kind of
The question is, did we have concerns about incorporating organic matter to that depth? We were concerned about anaerobic conditions, but in fact, we haven't found that in our study and in any of the installations in various cities. And we did find that actually this it's a methane sink, this particular practice under these conditions. So, but a lot of people asked that question initially. Yes.
Were those soils typically relatively coarse grained?
Well, they were well drained below the compacted zone. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they weren't poorly drained soils in their undisturbed state. Any other?
We can do one more. Short.
Well, maybe I'm wondering about extension. I contacted contractors.
Okay, so the question is, do contractors have any concerns about cracking foundations and so forth? I think that that hasn't been our experience. We did create a specification that's online, so if contractors want to use this method, there's a specification that's all available, and they can just download it and use it. And so it has been used in a number of situations, and I don't think anyone has tried to use it right up against a building. The closest I've seen is in Arlington. They did medians, and they installed it within about 6 to 12 inches from the curb underneath the road. But the alternative that they were going to use before they adopted this practice was actually soil replacement. So they were going to excavate the entire site and bring in a recycled soil. So I think that from that perspective, it didn't make any difference to them. So, any other questions? No? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Susan.